Folks, thanks for coming along tonight and overcoming the traffic jam in Sydney to get here. As you know, we have Dr. Philip Lowe talking for us this evening, and I'll introduce him briefly. He's well known, but I will introduce him briefly. Philip Lowe is the Deputy Governor of the Reserve Bank of Australia, a position he has held since February 2012. He's also Deputy Chairman of the Reserve Bank Board and is Chairman of the Reserve Bank Risk Management Committee. Prior to his current role, Dr. Lowe has held the positions of Assistant Governor Economics and Assistant Governor Financial Systems. He also spent 2 years with the Bank for International Settlements working on financial stability issues. Philip Lowe holds a PhD from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and the Ecom Honours in Economics, Econometrics at the University of New South Wales, and he's authored numerous papers, including on the linkages between monetary policy and financial stability. And tonight, the Deputy Governor is going to speak for us on the topic of demographics, productivity, and innovation. Philip Lowe, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jared, for that invitation and for the introduction. Thank you very much for the invitation to address the Sydney Institute. Over many years, the Institute's played a really important role in the intellectual life of our city and of our country. And the Reserve Bank has been a proud supporter of the Institute over many years. So it's a real honour for me to be able to speak to you this evening. As Jared said, the title of my remarks today is Demographics, Productivity and Innovation. And really what I'd like to do is to step back from the constant flow of high-frequency data on the Australian economy and to talk about a longer-run issue. And that is the potential links between demographic developments, productivity growth and our society's attitude to risk and to innovation. Now, to try and make these issues a little more concrete for you, could I begin by asking you to think about two questions? The first is, how has our society's attitude to risk and innovation changed over time? And what implications are there of any changes for productivity growth? And the second question is, as the population ages, how might our attitude to risk and innovation continue to change? Now, I apologise because these are not easy questions to answer. Understanding how people think about risk and what drives productivity are issues that the economics profession has struggled with for many, many years, and robust answers have been quite difficult to come by. That means that some of what I have to say this evening will be speculative, and for a conservative central banker, that's a slightly uncomfortable thing to do. Nevertheless, the questions are worth thinking about, and I believe they're worth talking about. Western societies are aging, and productivity growth in many advanced economies has slowed over recent times. In addition, businesses and households in many countries seem to have become more risk-averse. The proximate cause of this is the global financial crisis, although I suspect there are probably deeper factors at work. These developments rightly throw the spotlight onto the questions of how our society generates and funds the innovations that are so important for continued improvement in our living standards. Now, these issues might seem quite a long way from the short-term setting of the cash rate, which is the thing that keeps the Reserve Bank in the news almost every day. But understanding them is critical for us to do our job well. Demographic trends and productivity growth are central to understanding how fast the economy can grow without causing inflation to exceed the medium-term target. And while changes in demography and productivity have little influence on our month-to-month decisions on the cash rate, they do have an important bearing on the average level of the cash rate through time, and in effect, they set the contours within which we make our monthly decisions. So this evening, I'd first like to talk about recent demographic trends in Australia and compare those to what's happening overseas. I'd then like to talk about the productivity challenge that lies ahead and the importance of a culture that promotes innovation. And then finally, I'd like to link the demographic trends to this productivity challenge. So first to demography, which I don't think we talk about enough. Now, mostly demographic developments are not deemed to be newsworthy. And in the financial markets, the impending release of demographic information is not met with the same excited anticipation that sometimes accompanies the release of the latest monthly statistics. Yet demographic developments have a profound effect on our economy and on our society. And I'd like to draw your attention to three specific developments in Australia. The first is that our population is growing pretty quickly and has been for some time, which I hope you can see in this chart. Over the past 5 years, our population has increased by 9%, and it's projected to grow by another 9% over the next 5 years. So I think you can see the rate of natural increase has tended to slow a bit over recent decades, although this has been more than offset by a pickup in the rate of immigration. The result of this has been that we've experienced the fastest rate of population increase in more than three decades. As you can see from this next chart, most other developed economies find themselves in quite a different position, with the rate of population growth in the OECD as a whole only around one-third of that it's been in Australia. Indeed, our population has been rising at a faster rate than the population of almost any other country in the OECD. In a number of these countries, the population is actually declining, and the rate of decline is expected to accelerate. And Japan is perhaps the most prominent example here. In Japan, the population is projected to fall by 10% over the next 20 years, and the working age population is projected to fall by an almost unprecedented 17% over the next 20 years, and they're truly remarkable numbers. The second aspect of our demography that I want to draw your attention to is its diversity. According to the latest estimates, 28% of Australia's current population was born overseas. As you can see from this chart, which goes all the way back to 1893, this share has been steadily rising since the 1940s, and it's currently at its highest level since the late 19th century. The share is also very high by international standards. In most countries, immigrants account for less than 15% of the population, and in quite a few cases, the figure is in low single digits. As I think you can see here, amongst the larger advanced economies, only Switzerland has a higher share of immigrants in the population. I think it's also worth noting that on average, new immigrants to Australia are almost 10 years younger than the average Australian, and immigrants are also likely, or more likely, to have a post-secondary school qualification than does the average Australian. The third aspect of the demography that I want to talk about is the ageing of the population. And for the past 40 years or so, we've had somewhat of a demographic dividend in Australia. As you can see here, while the share of the population that's over 65 has been steadily rising, this has been more than offset by a decline of the share of children in the population. And as a result, the share of people of prime working age, defined here as those between 15 and 64, has trended higher. However, as you can see here, this trend has now turned around. And the share of the population in the 15 to 64 age group is now in decline. And that decline, based on current projections, is going to continue for many years to come. We're now starting to see the effect of this demographic transition in the monthly employment data. For many years, the participation rate, that's the share of the adults' population in the labour force, had been steadily rising. In contrast, over recent years, the participation rate has declined, and today it's back to the same level as it was in 2006. Now, part of this decline is cyclical, reflecting the current soft conditions in our labour market. But the analysis that we've done at the bank suggests that around half of the decline since 2010 is due to ageing, which is obviously a more structural factor. And the results of that analysis can be seen in this graph, which shows the actual participation rate, the orange line, along with our estimates of how the participation rate would have evolved had the age structure of the population been constant over time. And it's the blue line there, and you can see the clear difference. Given the ageing that's taking place, these data imply that the participation rate for all the various age groups will need to continue to increase if our overall participation rate is to again trend higher. Whether or not this happens will have an important bearing on future growth rates of our economy. Now, Australia, is not unique in having to deal with the challenge of an ageing workforce. Indeed, the changes taking place in a number of other advanced economies are much starker than those taking place here, and I think you can see that in this chart. Our relatively high population growth, which includes a flow of relatively young immigrants, means that a number of other countries, including those in Western Europe, Japan and South Korea, are much further along in this journey than we are. I guess from our perspective, the good news of this is that it provides us an opportunity to learn from their experiences. So in summary, our population's growing rapidly, it is increasingly diverse, and it's getting older. And I want to return to these themes in a few moments, but before I do that, I'd like to turn to the issue of productivity. As I've spoken about on other occasions, Australia faces a very major challenge here. Looking back over the past two decades or so, we've enjoyed faster growth in our real per capita income than almost any other advanced economy. In the 1990s, we benefited from very strong productivity growth. Then in the 2000s, our collective living standards were boosted by a very large rise in the terms of trade. And over much of this period, our national income was further increased by a rise in labour force participation that I mentioned a moment ago. But today, things look a little different. Productivity growth over the past decade has been lower than it was in the 1990s. Commodity prices, while high, are no longer rising. And the share of the population that's in paid employment has fallen recently. If these trends were to continue, we face the prospect of considerably slower growth in our living standards than we've become used to. And the solution here, although it's easier to do than to say, is to lift our productivity growth. Again, Australia isn't the only Western country facing this challenge. I think it's clear from this next chart. In almost all developed economies, productivity growth has been slower over the period since the mid-2000s than it was over the preceding decade. Now, there's quite a lot of debate about why this is the case. Now, one line of thought is that it's largely a legacy of the financial crisis, which, amongst other things, caused investment spending levels in many countries to fall to very low levels. But another line of thought is it's much more structural in nature. And a prominent advocate of this view is Professor Robert Gordon from Northwestern University in Chicago. He argues that the first three quarters of the 20th century was a golden period of productivity growth in the advanced economies. During that period, we worked out how to take full advantage of the transformational inventions of electricity and the internal combustion engine that occurred at the end of the 19th century. And while there have been many breakthroughs over recent times, Gordon argues that they pale into insignificance compared with the huge advances made possible by these iconic inventions at the end of the 19th century. Another sombre assessment is offered by Nobel laureate Edmund Phelps. he argues that the problem is not so much that we've run out of really great things to invent, but that Western societies are now less able to invent them. He argues that cultural changes, including the change role of government, have stifled the desire and incentive for innovation. As a result, he argues, our economies have become less dynamic and less likely to find, to develop, and to make use of the major technological breakthroughs that are the source of much productivity growth. Now, this is economics, and so there is a counter view. We have two hands, and the counter view is much more optimistic. This view is that the so-called techno-pessimists are fundamentally wrong, and that rather than facing a future of much slower technical progress, that we're actually on the cusp of a new era of great progress in science. Now, perhaps the most prominent advocate of this view is Robert Gordon's colleague at Northwestern, Joel Moyka, who argues that the technological advances of recent times have given scientists a dazzling new range of tools and instruments, which they're now using. These advances have also greatly lowered the cost of accessing and sharing information. And he argues that as a result of these changes, a new era of great scientific advancement is now possible. Now, I don't profess to know which of these views is correct. Only time will tell. But what underlies these debates is that the ability of a society to innovate, to take and manage risk, and to respond quickly to the changing world is a key determinant of the rate of productivity growth. Improvements in productivity require existing resources to be used more efficiently, or they require advances in technology. They don't occur from doing the same thing over and over again without ever changing it. So if we are to improve efficiency in advanced technology, then innovation is required, and innovation requires someone to take a risk. The risk of trying a new process, the risk of changing workplace or organisation management, the risk of spending scarce resources to explore a new idea. Now, sometimes the effort won't pay off, but just occasionally it will, and when it does, we find a better process, a more efficient organisational design, or an idea that transforms how we do things. The point I really want to emphasise here is that regardless of whether the techno-pessimists or the techno-optimists turn out to be correct, our attitude to risk-taking, to innovation, and to entrepreneurship have a significant influence on our future living standards. At this point, I really want to return to one of the questions that I asked you to think about at the beginning. How has our society's attitude to risk and innovation evolved over time? And what, if any, are the implications for productivity growth? My own tentative answer is that there has been a subtle but an important shift in the way we think about risk and innovation. In particular, our preferences appear to have shifted in such a way that we increasingly focus on risk mitigation and risk control. There are examples of this in a whole range of activities in our society, from the nature of the legislation that the parliaments pass, to the increase in compliance activities in our nation's boardrooms, to the amount of money we're prepared to spend to limit the probability of blackouts, and even to the attitudes about the design of children's playgrounds. In each of these areas, our society has been prepared to limit options and/or to spend some of our scarce resources to reduce risk. Now, I want to make it clear that I'm not saying that this is necessarily a bad thing. Wealthy societies like our own have considerable capability to address risks in a way that poorer societies just don't have. After all, that's really one of the benefits of economic progress. And it may also be the case that wealthy societies inherently have less tolerance for certain types of risk than do less wealthy societies. So what we are seeing may well be optimal from the perspective of our collective welfare, even if it doesn't maximise measured economic growth. But at least in my opinion, it is appropriate to occasionally ask whether we've got the balance right here. Reducing risks isn't always cost-free. Resources need to be devoted to the task, and this means that those resources can't be used elsewhere. Perhaps even more importantly, it might also be the case that a more risk-averse society is naturally less inclined to support and finance innovation, to implement new processes, and to apply new technologies. If this is indeed the case, then I think it has important implications for future productivity growth, not just in Australia, but in other Western countries as well. And here I want to circle back to the issue of demography, because some of the developments that I spoke about earlier do have the potential to shape how our society thinks about risk, how it thinks about innovation, and how it thinks about change. So you might recall the second question that I asked you to think about. How might society's attitude to risk and innovation change as a result of ageing of the population? Again, there aren't any definitive answers here. Older workers do have considerable accumulated experience, and that can be used to boost their own productivity and the productivity of our society. However, the available data, both in Australia and the US, suggests that individuals in their 30s and 40s have a considerably higher probability of becoming an entrepreneur than do older individuals. The take-up rate of new technologies is also higher for younger workers. And in addition, younger workers tend to be less risk-averse than older workers in their financial portfolios. All else constant, this higher degree of risk aversion of older citizens means that as the population ages, access to capital for more risky firms, especially startups, is likely to be more restricted and more expensive. Of course, again, there are factors working in the other direction. As the workforce ages, the incentive to find new labour-saving techniques is likely to increase. And as the rising pressure on public finances from ageing takes place, there should be an increased incentive for governments to find more efficient ways of delivering goods and services. So it's not yet possible to know what the net effect of ageing will be on our attitude to risk and innovation. But if ageing societies do become inherently more risk-averse and less supportive of innovation, as I suspect they might, then we are likely to face a greater challenge than we have to date in generating the productivity growth that we require. And this means there is likely to be more of a premium on getting policies right in some key areas related to innovation. And I'd like to mention five of these, although they're by no means exclusive. The first is the way in which we finance innovation, including the access to capital for new businesses. I think the financial system inquiry that's currently underway will be looking at this issue. The second is the incentives for innovation that we establish through our tax system. The third is the way in which we support human capital accumulation and research in this country. The fourth is the nature of our business culture and the way we promote and support entrepreneurship. And the fifth is the way in which we promote competition in our markets, for it's often competition, or at least the threat of it, that's the driver of innovation. Now, these are all incredibly challenging areas to get right, but they should all be on our collective radar screens if we are to maintain and strengthen the culture of innovation in an ageing society. I'd also briefly like to return to the two other demographic factors that I mentioned earlier, because I think there is a more positive story here. In particular, a reasonable case can be made that for both of these demographic factors, that is, the fairly fast population growth and the increasing diversity of our population, can actually promote innovation. If the population is growing quickly, then the overall size of the market is getting bigger every year, This creates new opportunities and can increase the payoff from taking a risk. And the increasing diversity of our population means that we have a constant influx of people coming to our shores, bringing with them new perspectives, new skills, and new ideas. While it's undoubtedly the case that high population growth and high levels of immigration can create challenges of their own, properly managed, they can also help create a more dynamic economy and a society with more opportunities for all. So I think there is reason for optimism here. In a number of areas, Australia's demographic trends are more favourable than those in place in most other Western countries. We have a strong record of adapting to change and allowing the marketplace to guide our adjustment. Our sound macroeconomic and financial frameworks also provide a basis for confidence. The challenge we face is to build on these advantages and to strengthen our collective ability to innovate and to adjust to a changing world. We will need to do this if we are to enjoy the type of growth in our living standards that we've become used to over the past 20 years or so. I'd like to thank you very much for being so patient and listening, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
So many thanks to Dr. Lowe, and thanks also to King and Wood Mallesons for providing this facility this evening. We've got plenty of time. So to what extent, I mean, it's a very interesting presentation there, to what extent do you think that what is commonly called the global financial crisis has had a negative impact on innovation, that there's a feeling that people don't want to take risk in this current climate, or is what you're talking about may well have occurred without the global financial crisis?
Well, I think that's a very good question. It's no doubt the case that the financial crisis caused both households and businesses everywhere to become more risk-averse. And you see this in many countries around the world. The corporate sector at the moment is actually very profitable in many countries. Corporations are sitting on large amounts of cash, and they're really saying that the best thing they can do with that cash is to leave it in banks earning very low interest rates. And I think that's partly because they're very cautious about the future. Kind of the hope from a cyclical perspective is that that caution will gradually lift and then firms will start employing that capital investing and creating jobs. So that's the cyclical dimension. But I do think there is a deeper structural thing going on, and that's coming about from both ageing and changes in people's perception about risk. That's kind of structural, it's very slow moving. But as I said in my remarks, I see lots of evidence of this, or things that I see as evidence of it in our society, where we're prepared as a society to spend more on risk mitigation. And I think it's structural, part of it's structural. And my fear is that it's going to become much more pronounced as the population ages. And that's going to create a big challenge for us all. Because in Australia, in the last 20 years, per capita real income has grown at 2.75% a year for 20 years. It's kind of, if you look at every other Western country, it's much lower than that. I think the average for the advanced economies as a whole is about 1.25%. Now, we've got used to very strong growth in our real effective living standards in this country. And we can only continue to do that if have growth in our living standards of anything like that if we really lift productivity growth. And this is why I think there's this focus on innovation, of creating a climate where people are prepared to take risk and be rewarded for that, is incredibly important to our future prospects.
Question
here. John Cargill from the Minerals Council. Thanks, Phil, for a very thought-provoking address. Can I just pick up on another dimension of the financial crisis, though, and that's around innovation in financial crisis? Given your sort of deep background in financial stability, I mean, arguably, there's a view that the finance sector was too innovative, and in fact, for the steady growth of an economy, you need the finance sector to be the handmaiden of the real economy. And perhaps doing the same thing over and over again in the finance sector isn't such a bad thing after all. So could I get you to perhaps explore a bit further financial product innovation, financial innovation more generally, and what are the payoffs or risks around that as you see them now, getting on to, I guess, 5 or 6 years on from the GFC?
Yeah. Well, kind of in a slightly different context, the one that I was speaking about, you can see just how important the risk culture is to the economic outcomes, kind of both in Australia and the globe, because the risk culture in financial institutions was turned out to be dreadfully inappropriate. The incentive structures that were set up within financial institutions to take risk were poorly designed. People misunderstood the risk, and there were very large macroeconomic consequences of that. So risk culture really matters, and it's clearest in finance, because if things go wrong with highly leveraged institutions, which what financial institutions are, there can be big non-linearities, and we saw it. So the risk culture really matters. And my point, my broader point is that it's not just true in finance. The risk culture in our society really matters. And the financial sector just showed kind of that in a very unhelpful way. The question, kind of the other part of your question really is, do we have too much financial innovation? And I suspect the answer is yes. But there are a lot of good things that can come from good financial innovation as well. Right? So I don't hope for a world in which the financial sector does not continue to innovate. We want that innovation, though, to serve business and consumers and not the insiders in the financial sector, which, sadly, that happened for too many years. But it's just the culture of innovation, the culture of risk-taking really matters.
Philip, I agree with all of your comments about what's driving some of this behaviour, but I want to throw one more hypothesis at you, just get your reaction. A lot of the industries that all the Western countries have, from the 1900s up till now, are quite mature industries. And in a lot of mature industries, you get a collapsing down of the number of competitors into a handful, whether it's car making or steel making or mining or banking or retail grocery. And often I see in that when you get a small handful of players, that they spend a lot of time defending market share and not often as much time trying to innovate. And I wonder if you would comment on at least my hypothesis that part of this has to do with the fact that we're just experiencing, the tail end of 100 years of a growth in a lot of industries that are now pretty mature, and that to expect them to wake up and completely trash their business models with some innovation is sort of unlikely.
Yeah, well, I don't know the answer to that. It's certainly the case that this is what Robert, you're really arguing the same thing that Robert Gordon's arguing, that there was this kind of burst of technical innovation, huge inventions, and then we took a better part of a century to work out how to do it, and the industries have become stale, and we haven't got the new round of innovations to drive the next round of growth in our economy. It's just very hard to know whether that's going to turn out to be correct, because I do have some sympathy for the view of Joel Merkel, because he is saying, and I think this is right, that there are a whole bunch of new industries actually coming forward, and the probability of those coming forward now has risen because information can flow around the world so quickly. People can discover something in one place in the world and the results of that are immediately available to people elsewhere in the world, whereas a decade ago, or 2 decades ago, that just wasn't the case. I was telling my colleagues at the bank the other day that when I came back from MIT in 1991, I'd just been using this thing called email. And I went to the IT department and said, we don't have that here. can we look at it? And they said, well, could you write a business case? And why would people want, you know, don't we have faxes? Anyhow, we gradually got email. But it's kind of an illustration to me that kind of the world is changing and information now flows around so quickly, we can have access to stuff, and that could actually be the catalyst for a new round of innovation. So the old industries sit there, not particularly dynamic, but new ones open up. I don't think anyone should claim they know the answer to how that's going to work out. But what I feel much more comfortable in arguing to you is that whether we're new range of technical possibilities or technical advances possible or not, the culture that we have is key. Because if those possibilities are out there, we've got to go and find them, and so the culture's key. And if they're not out there, we've got to really do the best with what we can, so the culture's key. So I think anyone who says they know the answer to that is really kidding, and probably not a very good answer to your question, but it's the best I can do.
Thanks very much, Deputy Governor. I just was curious. I was seeing some research from Finland, and they had this program, it was called START, I think it was, where the government, instead of loaning money or giving grants out to startup businesses, they would actually do something similar to like the convertible note, more like an investment directly into the shares of the startup. And they've got this entire program where they help and improve entrepreneur, help them out. I know Australia does a few of those things, but my question is really that they helped out some Nokia subsidiary companies grow to billions of dollars, and they reap the profits and the rewards of it. So it's the question is, could maybe that be a great way in which government can assist startups, hence assist productivity growth? And maybe that would be, I don't know, that inquiry you mentioned about access to capital.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I don't know enough about the specific example that you're talking about to comment on that. It is an issue that the Financial System Inquiry is going to look at. I think it's ready to be looked at. I hear from a lot of businesses or prospective business we talk to how difficult it is to start up, and one can understand that because it is risky. So what's the right balance between equity and debt, and who supplies the debt? They're kind of important issues, but I don't know enough about the particular scheme you're talking about.
Dr. Lowe, Clancy Yates from the Australian Financial Review. You mentioned the hope for sort of upswing in the cyclical sense, and last week the Reserve Bank said some of the recent economic figures were pointing to a stronger economy. Since then, we've had a plunge in the iron ore price, and then much weaker consumer and business confidence figures. Have they changed your reading on the economy?
I think the tradition of the Institute is to ask questions on the topic, but it's up to the Deputy Governor.
I'm happy to answer any question briefly. If you look across the whole suite of economic indicators, they're gradually improving. And I think what we see is the interest-sensitive sectors of the economy gradually picking up, and even some of the exchange rate-sensitive sectors of the economy now being a bit more optimistic as well. So I think it's inappropriate, really, to kind of be reacting to every single piece of short-run data that comes out. But the combination of low interest rates and a lower exchange rate, I think, have set the preconditions for a gradual recovery in the economy, and there'll be obviously fits and starts in that, but I think the general trend is an improving one.
I'd appreciate comments on two areas. One, how you see our superannuation system either working for or against productivity going forward. Also, looking at the education system, I see a lot of debate in education, but I don't see a lot of involvement by economists. And my feeling is that there is scope for, say, improving creativity in our education system. And I'm wondering if you see a role for economists in that area going forward?
Well, maybe if I take that second one first, because I see a role for economists everywhere. Because they're basically thinking about how to make the best of what we have, how to allocate our resources to get to get the best outcome. But I don't know enough about the specifics of the education industry to kind of offer you a comment on that. Superannuation. It is an incredibly important source of funding for the economy. And so the way in which the super industry employs that capital is very, very important. You've seen over recent years the kind of the super fund, well, really over the history of the superannuation industry, have very, very heavy investments in firm equity. I mean, you look at the composition of the Australian superannuation fund's balance sheet, and they're very, very heavy in equity. And that is that, you know, that's providing corporate funding, risk capital for firms. So that's a very, you know, that's a positive way in which they're supporting the firms in the economy. I think the other area where there is scope to look at this more carefully is in their role in financing infrastructure. Because another important contributor to productivity is having the infrastructure that our cities really need, and I have a particular interest in transportation infrastructure, because I think that's incredibly important for the way that people move around our cities, the way they connect with one another, the way that competition is brought to various markets, and there are obviously social benefits from having good transportation networks as well. So there is a role for, perhaps an important role for superannuation in the transport infrastructure space, but as I've said on previous occasions, the issues there are not the willingness of, in principle, of superannuation and other investors to finance this. It's the project selection, the governance of it, the way that the thing is actually constructed. They're the kind of the key issues. So if you can get those right, then I think that does create the possibility of super funds and other investors then come and be prepared to fund infrastructure, which I think would be a good thing for the economy.
Robert Dunn, Dr. Lowe. On the weekend, I read an interesting article which said that we have these corridors of innovation in our cities. I wasn't aware of that. I was pleased to read about it. I was surprised to read about it. But it caused me to wonder just how good are we at innovation in Australia relative to the rest of the world? So is there a measure of a quantitative measure about innovation and any relative measures against other countries?
Yeah. Well, it's a really hard thing to measure. The OECD, I think, has tried to come up with indices of innovation, and you know, whether you believe them or not, I think we rank not near the top, not near the bottom, somewhere in the middle. I think there are two aspects of this that are important. One is kind of basic new science, kind of coming up with new products, advancing the technical frontier. And Australia can do that a little bit in certain key industries, and we do that. But I think the bigger potential gains for us is not kind of pushing out the technical frontier, but in actually doing the day-to-day things that we do, doing them better. And to do them better, you've got to change existing processes. And that's another form of innovation. Taking advantage of inefficiencies in the existing processes, managing your workforce more effectively, dealing more effectively with your customers and suppliers. They're all forms of innovation. So when I talk about innovation, it's not just pushing out the technical frontier, it's making sure that we change in a way that makes the best of what we can actually do with the given technology. And I see many possibilities in our economy to do that. Even if we, 23 million people in the South Pacific, can't really be the ones that push out the global technological frontier, there are plenty of ways that we can use our existing resources more effectively if only we choose to do that. And that's innovation.
There's another back. Thank you very much. Two quick comments and your reaction, please. When Professor Christensen from Harvard was out recently, and he, of course, focuses on disruptive innovation. He gave the example of a company, a new startup in the car industry in America that was doing fantastically well, because instead of producing a product and then trying to convince people to buy it, it actually looked at what people needed and wanted, and so it produced a car for commercial travellers, so that there was broadband, there was a table, they could spread their papers and their laptop instead of having to go to McDonald's to in between meetings. That was one aspect, and it follows on from what you were saying about doing things better and a mindset. The second is very brief, and that is the lack of attention to science and technology in the primary school level, to get teachers who are passionate about it, and to get kids passionate about it. When you look at our production of engineers versus our production of lawyers and investment bankers, I'm a lawyer, but we try to innovate, but we really need some scientists, more scientists and more technologists. And you look at China and the amount they're producing. Thank you.
Well, I can only but agree with you, really. I mean, who could disagree with the principle that businesses need to look at what their customers need and want? It seems so obvious, doesn't it? But apparently it's so hard to implement. But the teaching of science, I think, is obviously important, very important. But, you know, I'm a humble central banker. I'm not an expert on every aspect of our education system. I do kind of just want to come back, though, to kind of it's we shouldn't be thinking about innovation just as pushing out the technical frontier. So if we think, you know, the push to improve productivity, we've got to lift the technological frontier, and we should spend a lot of resources as a country doing that. I think there's kind of a debate, you know, debate to be had about whether doing that. I think that the really big gains for us are actually not in pushing out the frontier, at least for the next little while, but they're actually doing things better. Examining existing practices, managing our workforces more effectively, having flexibility in the way we do that, having proper pricing of infrastructure, of having general flexibility in business. That's, you know, and allocating the resources, the resources that we have as a society, as efficiently as we can. There are big benefits to be gained there. And if you look at the list of things that the Productivity Commission has suggested, there is a long list there. And implementing that list, or a fair chunk of it, would make a difference to our collective living standards. But many of the issues here are difficult because it seems everyone would agree with pushing out the technological frontier. Who could disagree with that? But taking on distortions in the economy where we're not doing things appropriately or as efficiently as we can, that's very difficult. There's always someone who benefits from a distortion, of course, and they don't like it. So I'm trying to use innovation here in not just the technical frontier sense, but in the way we manage our businesses and allocate the resources domestically.
Yeah, it seems to me, like your comment on this, that in the new normal, all the technology is going to result in the need for fewer and fewer workers. And each company that certainly I deal with seems to be in a race to the bottom to get the most possible customers and the fewest number of workers. I'm just wondering, going forward, what we're going to do with all those workers, particularly with the increasing immigration. Mm.
Well, with the greatest respect, I think I fundamentally disagree with you. Because what technical progress does is allows firms to produce output with fewer workers, but it produces output, and that output generates wealth, and then that wealth gets spent in the economy. And what happens over time is that wealth increasingly gets spent on services. So what we've seen is as our society has grown and become more wealthy, the services share of the economy has grown, because we need to spend less resources now making carpet and tables and chairs and clothing. That's true. Kind of globally, we don't need to spend as many resources doing that. But that's correct. The fact that we can do that all more efficiently, there's income generated from that, and that income is generated on a whole range of services. And so in every country that's gone through this technological progress, right, fewer people in production of goods, but many more in the production of services. And you see that even in our own economy, the huge growth in the service sector employment. You know, hundreds of thousands of new jobs created in education and health, in the restaurant and accommodation sectors. And we've only been able to do that, Australia and other Western countries have only been able to do that because they've become more productive in producing goods, in having fewer workers and more capital and better technology producing the goods. So I'm kind of, I think in the longer run, this technological improvement and fewer workers in manufacturing is great. It's great for our collective living standards and it's not a threat to employment.
This may be off your planet, but you're a banker and you're talking about the ways in which we can be more productive and whatever, and I'm wondering in all of this, what's the role of government? More or less, giving confidence? We're having a discussion at the moment about the taxation system, which many people think is desperately in need of review. What would be your advice to government? Because after all, we're all the masses. We can only do so much, and the rest of it has to be done by the chief executive, which is the government.
Well, I'm not in the business of giving advice to the government. I think that's a dangerous thing for central banks to do. But you know, I think the general observation I would make, though, is that it's incredibly important for the government to act consistently with policy so that people understand where the government's coming from in the policy framework, because I think that does reduce uncertainty. And if you reduce uncertainty, that allows businesses to plan, to be prepared to take a risk. What I hear, and I was happy to be staying corrected by the business people in this room, but what I hear is that kind of uncertainty from the political level does bear on their willingness to take a risk. So I think consistency of policy, predictability in policies, very important. I'd also make the observation that the culture of the political class is quite important, because if the politicians can create a culture that promotes entrepreneurship, that facilitates change, that makes it easier for resources to flow around the economy, that's going to be a better world for us. And they can promote that culture both through their policies and their language. Beyond that, I don't think I'm prepared to go any further. Thank you.
We're getting very close to the end now. There's a question down there.
Yeah. Rory Robertson. Doctor, I think a really interesting talk. You worry about, we've got really used to rapid growth in living standards, and you worry that so much energy is being put into risk mitigation in our playgrounds, in our classrooms, in transport systems and business and finance. I wonder if a big part of the story isn't simply that as we've got wealthier, so each decade we've grown, living standards have grown by 2% per year for five decades, and we've got to a living standard where most of us here and many downstairs don't want for much. We've sort of solved the problem of putting food on the table and roofs over our heads. But what if it's just not a natural development for wealthier economies to actually spend more time giving priority to risk mitigation, and that we've only got 1, 2, 3, 4 kids. If you had 10, if you lost one, it didn't matter very much. Just prioritize. There's a whole literature now about how we feel the pain of losses much more than we sort of enjoy gains. I wonder if that's not part of the story.
Well, as I tried to indicate in my remarks, I think that is possible. That wealthy societies just have different preferences, and really what we're seeing through the various things that I talked about is really just a reflection of those preferences, and this is entirely optimal. I don't know whether that's the case. I think we probably get a better answer if we have a kind of a society-wide conversation, that we talk about these issues openly and widely in our society, and I think kind of thank you for giving me the opportunity to do that. I just don't know. But I think we should be making, if this is optimal, then we should be making the decision consciously, and we shouldn't just be drifting into this. And I fear that as the population ages, we could drift into a society that's much less tolerant of change, much less embracing of doing things differently. That may be okay, but if we're going to do that, then we should do it consciously, and we should understand the consequences of doing that.
Question, you've got to be very quick. Yeah. All right. Yes, some has disagreed that you can't actually decree productivity according to demographics or even ordain innovation, but only reward it or punish it. So if that is not true, my question is that how do you actually measure the productivity of a new invention in your thoughts? And if we're only relying on experts of existing businesses, aren't we confining ourselves to the past? How can the experts of that does not exist, things that does not exist? Thank you.
Yeah. Well, I agree with your first point. You can't ordain it. I mean, you've got to create the environment in which people are prepared to invent a new technology or do something more effectively. That's all you can do. You can't kind of demand that this be taken. It's the result of the private sector mainly taking decisions to do things better. The measures of productivity that people normally talk about is GDP per hour worked. Both of those things are fairly easy to measure. And maybe kind of in follow-up into Rory's comment, that maybe what he's really getting at is that kind of what we measure of GDP is not a good summary statistic of economic welfare. And so we can do things that actually increase our collective welfare but don't increase our measured output. And that raises a whole set of much more complicated issues, because how do you measure welfare? The economics profession has really got quite good at measuring physical output and output of services, but we're not very good at measuring welfare. And lots of people have had you could imagine kind of setting up a system of accounts that measured welfare per unit of our work. It's just much harder to do that. Maybe one day we'll get there, maybe we'll have some innovation in measurement, but I think we're still a long way from being able to do that with any great science.
Just a final question on your demographics, and I'm not asking you to predict what might happen, but if that figure on the age of the population and the resignation of many members of the workforce and the drop in the participation rate, if that continues, and on that kind of graph you would expect it would, then you might be reasonable to think that the unemployment level would at least stabilise,
might decrease.
Is that the way you're thinking about unemployment?
If
that trend goes the way it's currently going?
Not necessarily, because I view the unemployment rate.
Yes.
In principle, the change demographics needn't have any implication, longer term implication for the unemployment rate, because ultimately the unemployment rate is determined by the level of wages in the economy and relative to the ability of firms to produce goods and services. So it's really a question of what wage rates go with the change of demographics. And people who look at Japan, where this is much more advanced, predicting rises in relative wages in Japan, if that were not to occur, then you could have excess demand for labour. If it would occur too much, and you've got very large wage rises, and you could have unemployment. So it's really an outcome of the wage process rather than the demographics. But as I said, in Japan, people worry about a shortage of workers pushing up wages, and just how far that process goes will determine what happens to the unemployment rate. And I think that analysis is probably applicable here as well.
Well, many thanks, Deputy Governor. We've got more.